folks. It's time for Native Sun, bringing you news of Indian country on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Your reader is Bethany Williams. From the AZ Mirror, Biden launches a national plan for indigenous language protection and revitalization by Shandine Silversmith, published on the 9th of December, 2024. To support the revitalization, protection, preservation, and reclamation of indigenous languages across the United States, the Biden-Harris administration released a 10-year national plan on Native revitalization during the 2024 White House Tribal Nations Summit. Indigenous languages are central to our cultures, our lifeways, and who we are as a people, Secretary of Interior Deb Haaland said in a press release. They connect us to our ancestors, to our homelands, and to our place in the world. The national plan is a joint effort between government agencies that outline strategies to help address the government's role in the loss of indigenous languages among Native American, Alaska Native, Native Hawaiian, and Pacific Islander communities. This ambitious plan represents the Biden-Harris administration's commitment to address the wrongs of the past and restore what has been taken from us, Haaland said. The Departments of the Interior, Education, and Health and Human Services produced the plan. The National Plan on Native Language Revitalization is the result of the Department of Interior's work to address the systematic and deliberate policies set in place by the United States to forcibly assimilate indigenous peoples and eradicate indigenous languages and cultures as part of the federal Indian boarding school system. Congressional authorization and funding of this plan will reduce the number of vulnerable and endangered Native languages and increase the number of proficient Native language speakers as defined by Native Americans, according to the report. The Department of Interior launched the Federal Indian Boarding School Initiative in 2021. The initiative released two reports that highlighted the devastating impact the boarding school system had and continues to have on indigenous communities. It also provided a complete list of all federally operated schools. President Joe Biden became the first sitting president to formally acknowledge and apologize to indigenous communities in October for the federal government's role in developing and enforcing the policies. The legacy of forced assimilation continues to threaten the existence of many Native languages, and the legacy of the boarding school era echoes in today's educational experience for Native students, according to the report. The report states that congressional action is required to preserve indigenous languages. If action is not taken, fewer than 20 indigenous languages will still be in use in America by 2050. There are 167 currently spoken. We use language to write history, share knowledge, map the future, and pass down traditions, Secretary of Health and Human Services Javier Becerra said in a written statement. Investing in language revitalization strengthens communities and contributes to their resiliency. The plan prioritizes investing in and supporting indigenous language efforts within academia. The plan calls for strategic investments in core content instruction in indigenous languages to improve the educational outcomes for all indigenous youth. I always say multilingualism is a superpower, and that includes Native American languages, Secretary of Education Miguel Cardona said. Cardona said he traveled through Indian country as Secretary of Education and learned words in the Oneida, Dakota, and Nakota languages. One thing was crystal clear. When young people reclaim their native languages, they reconnect deeply with who they are and where they come from, he said. But Native peoples have suffered from shameful policies that aimed to eradicate these languages and cultures for too long. Cardona added he's hopeful that this national plan will be the start of the government's remediation for its participation in federal Indian boarding school policies that have impacted indigenous communities for generations. I'm hopeful we can all choose to keep fighting for a future where Native communities have the tools and support to keep their languages alive and their cultures thriving, he said. According to the Department of Interior, the Bureau of Indian Education, or BIE, funds 187 schools for Indigenous students and works to provide them with culturally relevant, high-quality education. However, the BIE did not receive funding for language revitalization until 2017, and the appropriations have not exceeded $7.5 million for any year. $7.5 million, that is. As part of the summit, the Department of Interior also announced a cooperative agreement with the National Fund for Excellence in American Indian Education, which will provide a $7.5 million in existing grant funding to BIE schools supporting the launch or expansion of immersion programs. This funding will help build a network of BIE schools committed to integrating Native language immersion and cultural education into their curricula, offering students the tools to connect with their language and heritage, the department stated in a press release. Together with the National Plan for Native Language Revitalization, these efforts create a comprehensive strategy to protect, preserve, and reclaim Indigenous languages across the United States. That was Biden Launches National Plan for Indigenous Language Revitalization. More about the White House Tribal Nations Summit. Biden proclaims a new national monument at Carlisle. This was published on the 9th of December, 2024. And it was written by Mary Annette Pember and Jordan Bennett Begay of ICT. President Joe Biden announced the creation of a new national monument on the site of the former Carlisle Indian Industrial School to honor the tens of thousands of students who attended boarding schools as part of the government's brutal efforts at forced assimilation of Native people. The proclamation designating the Carlisle Federal Indian Boarding School National Monument was released on Monday, December 9th, at the fourth and final White House Tribal Nations Summit in Washington, D.C. The proclamation came just 6 weeks after Biden issued an historic apology to Native people for the government's ugly boarding school history, in which Native children were often forced from their families to attend a school where they were stripped of their culture, families, and language. By establishing a new national monument at the site of the former Carlisle School, President Biden is acknowledging the federal boarding school era, advancing healing, and commemorating the resilience of tribal nations and Indigenous peoples, the White House said in a press release Monday. The new national monument will tell the story of the oppression endured by thousands of Native children and their families at this site and the harmful legacy of the broader Indian boarding school system that the federal government operated or supported across the country for more than 150 years, officials said. The monument will sit on 24.5 acres of land encompassing the historic buildings and structures that made up the campus of the Carlisle School, including the school road gateposts that were built by Native youths at the school. The gateposts still stand today as a marker of the removal and separation of children from their families, tribes, and homelands. The monument, however, will not include the Carlisle Cemetery, where the remains of children are still buried, as the U.S. Army works to return them to their tribal communities and families. No single action by the federal government can adequately reconcile the trauma and ongoing harms from the federal Indian boarding school era, Interior Secretary Deb Haaland, Laguna Pueblo, said in a press release issued by the Department of the Interior. But taken together, the Biden-Harris administration's efforts to acknowledge and redress the legacy of assimilation policy have made an enduring difference in Indian country, said Haaland, whose great-grandfather and grandparents were taken from their families and forced into boarding schools. One of the reasons I launched the Federal Indian Boarding School Initiative was to ensure that this important story was told. Through the National Park Service, America's Storyteller, people can now learn more about the intergenerational impacts of these policies as we, as a nation, continue to take steps to heal from them. The two-part boarding school investigation concluded with recommendations for an apology from the United States for the boarding school history and for a national memorial to recognize the survivors and those who did not return home to their families. Biden personally issued the apology in October at the Gila River Indian Community in Arizona. Deb Parker, a citizen of the Tulalip tribes, an executive director of the National Native American Boarding School Healing Project, known as NABS, who attended the summit, said the monument will honor the survivors as well as those children who died at the school and never made it home. We at NABS are pleased to know this will be taking place in honor of the children, children who never came home from these boarding schools, Parker told ICT. The Carlisle School, established in 1879, was the first federal Indian boarding school in the United States and operated until 1918. About 7,800 Native children from more than 140 tribes were forced or coerced under penalty of law to leave their homes and live at the school as part of the federal government's assimilation policy. The stated goal of the government's coercive education policy was to obliterate tribal culture, languages, and spirituality as a means to divest Native peoples of their lands and resources. The Carlisle School served as a model for the federal Indian boarding school system, which operated into the mid-20th century with more than 400 federal schools, as well as hundreds of similar institutions operated by religious organizations that also receive federal funding. Carlisle and its successors served as models for Canada in later establishing that country's Indian residential school system. Carlisle, with its military-style regimented culture, set the tone for subsequent schools in which children routinely endured physical, emotional, and sexual abuse. Students were separated from family, beaten for speaking their native languages, and often subjected to hard labor. At least 973 children died at Indian boarding schools, according to the Department of Interior's Federal Indian Boarding School Initiative investigation. But Interior leaders noted the number of deaths is likely far greater. About 180 children died at Carlisle and were buried in the school cemetery. The school site in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, now houses the U.S. Army's Carlisle Barracks. Today, the barracks, one of the country's oldest military installations, is home to the U.S. Army War College. The Army is currently implementing what it calls its Carlisle Barracks Disinterment Program, which has disinterred and returned 41 children to their families. The program is overseen by the Office of Army Cemeteries, which has been the subject of a lawsuit by tribal nations for failing to follow the rules of the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, NAGPRA, by adhering to military regulations regarding the return of the remains of children who died at Carlisle. The Office of Army Cemeteries oversees the Carlisle Cemetery along with other military cemeteries. Neither the White House, the Office of Army Cemeteries, nor Holland's office responded to requests from ICT for comment on why the student cemetery was omitted from President Biden's designation. The new national monument will be cooperatively managed by the National Park Service and the U.S. Army. The National Park Service, in coordination with the Army, will work with tribal nations in developing a plan for ongoing management of the monument. The Carlisle Monument is President Biden's 12th national monument designation. That article was Biden Proclaims New National Monument at Carlisle. You're listening to Native Sun on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Sun Sounds of Arizona has been bringing the disabled audio access to print information for over 40 years. Learn more at our website, sunsounds.org, where you can listen to our live streams or find individual episodes on demand. You can now also listen to us on the Sun Sounds app, which is available for both iPhone and Android devices. From High Country News. Can Farmington Hide It From Its Legacy of Anti-Indigenous Violence by B. Toasty Oster, published December 1, 2024. Note, this story includes details about lethal hate crimes. Oil, then settlers, then violence, then protests, tensions, and more violence, in a cycle of conquest and dispossession. Those are structural issues that are baked into the psyche of Farmington, said Melanie K. Yazzie, Diné, assistant professor of American Indian Studies at the University of Minnesota. Yazzie co-authored Red Nation Rising, From Border Town Violence to Native Liberation, which examines anti-Indigenous violence in towns abutting reservation, places like Gallup, Albuquerque, and Farmington, where natives buy groceries and building supplies, work, go dancing, or just hang out. Border towns are places that really help us see how settler order operates, she said. Farmington, New Mexico, a town of 46,000, about 30 miles from the Shiprock community on the Navajo Nation's eastern border, is an oil and gas town with a reputation for male settler violence. For decades, non-Indigenous teens and young men in the Navajo Nation's border towns have beaten and harassed Diné people, usually those living on the streets or intoxicated, in a cruel coming-of-age game known as Indian rolling. Some non-natives claim it's a thing of the past, but native residents say it remains a serious problem. In 1974, one such game unraveled into triple homicide when three white Farmington teens tortured three Diné men in a canyon outside a wealthy neighborhood. They took Benjamin Benali, John Harvey, and David Ignacio into Chokecherry Canyon, up a four-wheel trail behind churches and expensive houses overlooking the city. They put firecrackers in the men's orifices and beat their heads with rocks in what became known as the Chokecherry Murders. Afterward, the grieving Diné community protested in Farmington for seven successive Saturdays, with support from leaders of the American Indian Movement. Eventually, Farmington settlers had enough. The police attacked protesters, tear-gassing them, and arresting 30 people. Some non-natives, including the current mayor, say Farmington is not a violent place, but longtime Diné community members and human rights activists say improvements have been modest and underlying issues remain unaddressed. 50 years after the Chokecherry murders, in September of 2024, about 20 people marched through Farmington again. Representatives of the Diné community, the American Indian Movement, and non-Native supporters made their way up Broadway and down Main Street, downtown's two arteries, as the pavement radiated desert heat through the soles of their sneakers and moccasins. Farmington needs to be reminded of its history, said Chili Yazzie, Diné, former Shiprock chapter leader and longtime community activist. But he said the demonstration's primary goal was to bolster healing, especially for the victims' families. Chili Yazzie, who is not directly related to Melanie Yazzie, also marched in 2006, after a non-native Farmington cop killed Clint John, a Diné man in a Walmart parking lot, shooting him three times in the chest, then once in the head. As far as we're concerned, the white police officer murdered this young man, Yazzie said. After a reportedly all-non-native jury acquitted the officer, the Navajo Nation Human Rights Commission was formed. Yazzie, who was chairman for 4 years, visited 13 border towns around the reservation. Farmington is the poster child of racial violence, he told HCN. This is the hotbed. That same summer, three young white men in a truck picked up a Diné man, William Blackie. They asked him to buy them beer, but took him outside of town instead and brutalized him alongside the road, yelling racial slurs before fleeing. Blackie, bleeding from the head, called 911 and begged the cops not to shoot him. He survived. In July 2014, a few hours south of Farmington, Indian rolling in Albuquerque left two dead. Anti-Indianism in New Mexico has a particular flavor, said Melanie Yazzie. In 1880, an intoxicated Farmington settler shot a Diné man in the street for target practice. And in 1978, Chili Yazzie picked up a hitchhiker between Shiprock and Farmington, a white boy wearing a Clint Eastwood-style slouchy hat and a poncho. When Yazzie pulled over so the hitchhiker could relieve himself, the boy shot him in the right arm, then in the side. He was later sentenced to jail time. Yazzie fled, hitchhiking to the hospital where his arm was later amputated. This September's march was different from the 1974 protests. The city sponsored it, provided bottled water for participants. The police blocked off the streets with patrol cars, but kept their presence discreet. Farmington Mayor Nate Duckett said he gave them no special instructions to do so. The demonstration culminated at the Tota Theater in downtown Farmington. Tota, the Diné name for the Farmington area, means in-between water, where community leaders discussed the racial climate, past and present. The mayor declined an invitation to speak. "I already had prior engagements that weekend and was out of town, so I was not able to attend," Duckett told HCN in a phone interview. When asked what those prior engagements were, he said, "I don't think what I do out of town is any of your business, sir." He wouldn't say whether his trip was official or personal. "It was whatever it was, but I already had things that were planned out of town, so I was not able to attend. What were you doing this weekend?" Instead, he sent a statement to be read, in which he stressed how far Farmington had come since the 70s. "As much as we remember that painful past," it read, "we must also recognize the journey this community has made since then. Together we work to heal, to grow, and to overcome." John Redhouse, a longtime Diné activist who grew up in Farmington and participated in the 1974 marches, spoke after the mayor's statement. "White people say there's no more racism, there's no more genocide," Redhouse said. "That's not true. They've never been on the receiving end of racism and hate crimes. We're the only ones that have standing and truth to make that statement." Melanie Yazzie agreed, calling the statement total garbage. She said economics and gender are among the factors contributing to anti-Indigenous border town violence. "Farmington is an epicenter of resource extraction," or as Duckett put it in an interview with Native America Calling earlier this year, "a town built on the backs of oil and gas." Despite the extraction of Native wealth, Native people have historically held mostly low-paying jobs and, until recently, had little or no presence in city government. Nevertheless, Navajo Nation residents spend 70 cents of each dollar they have in border towns like Farmington, which is also a hub for other Indigenous communities, including the Ute Mountain Ute tribe and the Jicarilla Apache Nation. "There are such high populations of Native people, and we are seen as a threat, and we are treated as such by police," said Melanie Yazzie. "When uniformed officers abuse Natives," she said, "vigilantes, militias, and gangs of settler teens follow, often as a rite of passage." She said it's no coincidence that Choke Cherry Canyon, site of the 1974 killings, is up a trail where male settlers express their masculinity through off-roading. "If one of the primary expressions of settler masculinity is to uphold settler order, and if the settler order is about eliminating Indigenous people so as to claim final jurisdiction to the land," she explained, "then that helps to understand why these things happen." Most non-Natives aren't committing hate crimes. "Racism is perpetrated by a small pocket of the community," said Chili Yazzie, "while the majority of the white community may just be immersed in white privilege, whether they realize it or not." He noted the good-hearted white residents who are friends, like the First Presbyterian Church leaders who helped organize the September March. James Klotz, pastor of First Presbyterian, says he's long been haunted by the question of the church's stance on racial issues. Klotz helped organize the march after talking with Diné congregational members and the victim's descendants. In a church newsletter, quoting the Presbyterian Church's statement of faith, he wrote, "I was gratified and humbled to see that, as far as First Presbyterian Church goes, we make our stand on the side to hear the voices of people long silenced and to work for justice, freedom, and peace." Duckett said racism exists in every community. He believes the solution is for people to treat each other with civility. A 2005 report about Farmington by the New Mexico Advisory Committee to the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights declared that the climate of tolerance and respect between the two cultures is a marked improvement from the conditions the committee observed 30 years ago, in 1974. But activists say it isn't enough. They want a city monument commemorating the Chokecherry murder victims. Duckett told HCN he's open to considering a positive monument that focuses on how we work together going forward. He said he hasn't seen the proposed plans yet. There's too much divisiveness in the world. Melanie Yazzie argues that the problem runs deeper than individual animosity. It has to do with the very foundation of settler colonialism. Racism, Chili Yazzie added, is an offshoot of the global problem of white supremacy, which he never expects to see solved. But things can still improve. White privilege is very prominent in Farmington, he said. For there to be healing, that needs to be addressed. If you're a native in the West who's experienced racism in a reservation border town, we want to hear from you. Email your story to b.toastie@hcn.org. That's b.toastie@hcn.org. That was Can Farmington Hide from Its Legacy of Anti-Indigenous Violence? You've been listening to Native Sun, the show for Indigenous issues on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Your reader is Bethany Williams. Music is Land Back by Hallucination.